I'm Richard Dugan. Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. This is the fourth in our 12-part series on Mythosophia, entertaining the depths of myth and wisdom. And my guest co-host, if you will, is Will Lynn. And Will, welcome back to the program. It's good to have you back here in April, the end of April. We have a very interesting program coming up in this edition, but we also have some interesting notes for upcoming programs as well. I'm thinking that maybe we may preface this segment as well as our interview with our special guest by, I don't want to call it a disclaimer, but I want to let our listeners know that we're talking from a philosophical perspective, mythological perspective. This is not intended to generate offense or and sometimes I hate to do that because then people are looking for those kinds of things. We're trying to discover things. We're trying to understand. We're trying to get to the depths of what is and what isn't about all of these mindsets, all of these philosophies when we talk about mythology. And today, even more so, just because of, I think you would agree, the underlying tensions that are going on around the world with this subject matter we're going to be talking about today.
Yeah, so today we're going to be talking about Eden, and Eden is one of those few stories that's consistent between all the Abrahamic traditions. And so the Jews, Christians, and Muslims. And there are slight tweaks on the story that some people might see as slight tweaks and some people might see as a world of meaning. And today we're going to be meeting with Zaman Stanazide, and he is going to be helping us look at it from an Islamic point of view and especially look at some of the nice little additions to the myth that – I'm going to call it a religious myth today because we're talking about something that is for many people is such an active religion that, that I know it's risky to call it a myth. So we'll say the religious story, we're going to be looking at it a little bit from an we're going to be looking a little bit at the Islamic additions to the story. And then we're later, a round table, we're going to have a round table at the Ojai Foundation with Arthur George also on Eden. And he's going to come at it from a more maybe comparative mythological approach. And I'm thinking that these two, kind of like last time with Dara and Saffron, I think these two roundtable and radio show will really complement each other nicely.
I think so too, and of course we're going to have someone I think I'm real interested in talking with coming up in our May edition of Mythosophia. Tell us about this gentleman.
Well, Glenn Slater is a professor at Pacifica, and he teaches a lot of depth psychology courses, and he's taught in the mythology program. He's been a professor of mine, and I'm very excited to have him on. One of the best excuses is that we've had an ongoing back and forth a little bit about Star Trek and the Borg, and this is something he's put a lot of study and research and effort into working out and looking forward into the potential futures of human hybridization, the pros and cons of that. And so we'll be looking at myth and psyche, but we'll also be looking at the Borg and modern mythology with Star Trek, and we'll be looking at technology and the future of technology in our culture and its immersion into our own bodies. And so Glenn's great. It's going to be a great talk.
I'm looking forward to that. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. In terms of our subject matter for today, I'm curious as to how much you know about the Quran, the Muslim faith, if you will, because I know you study mythology, but is this an area that you really haven't delved into as much as the Greek and the Roman myths and so forth?
Well, you know, for example, if I were to study Norse mythology, they're very limited. There's very limited amount of content on Norse mythology, and it's not. Well, I would hate to say it's not living because it certainly is, and it might even be being reborn. But the way that Islam exists and Christianity and Judaism exists in our world is as very massive world religions. And so for that reason, the couple classes I've taken on Islam definitely don't leave me comfortable saying I know a lot about it, you know, especially in our charged environment. But it's something that, I mean, I have read a lot of the Quran. I've written, I've taken a couple classes on Islam and I have familiarized myself with some things that I think are really brilliant about the Prophet. For example, he's especially he's a returner. He's a person that comes back to this world and is a husband, is a father, is a leader, is, and this is a message in religion and spirituality that I think is very important, and he's one of the best figures making it, that religion doesn't necessarily mean leaving our culture and leaving our families and leaving our, you know, domestic lives. In fact, he's a great example of someone who maximized that. And that's just one of the many examples of the deep respect I have for the Islamic tradition.
I remember an interview that I conducted with a gentleman back in 1988 or 89, and he was visiting the Phoenix area, and he was with an organization called Christians and Muslims for Peace.
Hmm.
And one of the things that he shared with me that he does not speak about as openly as he would like is he says that the Christians and the Muslims have more in common than the Christians and the Jews. And I thought that was rather intriguing, and I certainly can understand why he probably wouldn't voice that too loudly. We certainly will. And we'll find out if that is really true, if there are more commonalities between the Christians and the Muslims. And I suppose in one aspect, because you and I would agree that no belief system comes out of a void.
Mm-hmm.
There is a progressiveness, if you will. Judaism, as far as the three, came first, followed by Christianity, followed by the Muslim faith.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what's next, if there is anything next.
Right.
Each one claims that they are that theirs is the final one, that this is the way to go.
Right. And picking one over another that at least for this program it's in our agenda to avoid that.
We're trying to understand.
Effort here to study, to explore. And I think actually one of the things I'm really looking forward to asking Zaman about is he's very he teaches political science, and we'll give a full bio of him right when we have him on, but he can very much be a little bit of a psychopomp guide for us into some of these issues from a point of view that is not as commonly distributed and disseminated in our culture. And I've listened to him speak before, both YouTube videos and by the way, you can check him out at stanazai.org, stanazai.org, and he has some of his great YouTube videos on there and lectures. But you know, I've had class with him. I've watched videos of him. I've gone to see him speak at conferences and. What he has to offer on both the politics and the myth is we really ought to ask him about both.
I'm really looking forward to it. Changing subjects only ever so slightly, because you are working on your dissertation.
Yeah.
I'm curious as to how that's coming.
It's coming. I actually took something like 400 or 500 pages worth of quotes in the last couple weeks. Quotes on Hercules and quotes on. Actually, I did a conference presentation on the cave that Adam enters when he dies, according to a lot of legends, both Jewish, Christian, and Islamic, and then the cave that Christ transcends, and then the cave that Muhammad enters into when he begins receiving the word. And so I did a presentation on the cave, and so I looked at these three Abrahamic figures, Adam, Christ, and Muhammad, and I took a lot of quotes for that. But so I was going back to a lot of my primary source quotes on Eden. Eden is a big part of my dissertation, too, so I'm very happy to be able to talk about it and ask some questions about it with somebody who's built a career partially around that particular story.
Would I be that far off when you talk about the symbolism of the cave, to see that as the womb of
Definitely
Mother Earth?
One. Yeah, that's one of the things I'm reading a lot of. You know, Eliade, Campbell, a lot of these comparative mythologists who are looking at multiple traditions, that's one of the simplifications that's very easy to make, and it's very common because it is common. You see the language in old rituals and old religions and old myths from Native American traditions all the way to, you know, Near Eastern traditions where there is a sense of the tomb as the womb.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, this again, I'm really looking forward to having our guest in studio, and certainly the next 7 or 8 months that we have left in this series of programs should be quite exciting, the information. And again, the whole purpose of this program, whether we're talking about Mythosophia or we're talking about any other subjects, we're just trying to understand, just trying to get a grasp of and maybe incorporate some of those puzzle pieces that our guest has to offer mm-hmm. into our own puzzle, and seeing if we can't make things fit together a little, make more sense of the life that we're living as individuals.
Yeah, pull us deeper.
Us deeper. Yeah. Entertaining the depths of myth and wisdom is Mythosophia. That is the program that you are listening to here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm here with Will Lynn, and we're going to come back with our guest in just a couple of moments. Just a reminder that if you would like to listen to this program, you certainly can do so online at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. It's also archived at richarddugan.com. And if I'm correct, once the videos, mm-hmm. we are videotaping this program, and we're literally using tape, folks. It's it is videotaped and then edited, and then it's going to be made available at mythosophia.com.
That's right.
It is a website, and you go to mythosophia.com, and then there's a link called Mythosophia. You click on that, and you can see the last two or three interviews that we've done.
So far, we have all of the audio so far up on there, but we have the first video with Dennis. We're about to do a series and get a big chunk of several of them up there soon.
Well, it should be good. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. This is Mythosophia, entertaining the depths of myth and wisdom. We will be right back.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. This is Mythosophia, and we are entertaining the depths of myth and wisdom. Will Lynn is my co-host for this series of programs. And again, welcome back, Lynn. And we're going to turn it over to you to introduce our guest and topic for this program.
So Zaman Stanazai is professor of Islamic studies at the Pacifica Mythological. Wow. Can we start that over? I've never done that so bad before.
Okay.
We can just edit that section out, and I'll just start from there.
Start from that point.
Jeez, I've never
done that. 3, 2, 1.
So welcome to Zaman Stanazai, is a professor of Islamic studies at Pacifica Graduate Institute in the Mythological Studies program. And he also teaches political science at California State University, Dominguez Hills. He received an MA in linguistics from the University of Washington and earned his doctorate in political science from the University of Southern California in LA. Dr. Stanazai has worked in the Indo-Iranian languages as a Fulbright scholar and has focused his postdoctoral studies on Islamic culture and mysticism in depth and sacred psychology. He's written extensively on political philosophy, especially on issues of identity politics and third world states encountering globalization. Both professionally and personally, Dr. Stanazai is also passionately engaged in the art of poetry. He's translated works by Rumi, Hafiz, and Rahman Baba, and has published his own poetry in Pashto and Dari Persian verse. You have to correct my pronunciation on those poetic verses. But welcome, Zaman, and thanks for coming to join us to talk about the mythology of Eden.
Thank you for inviting me.
I thought maybe the best place for us to get started is the story itself. And so I thought maybe most of us are probably familiar with the basic story. You know, Adam and Eve are created. Adam's created. Eve's created from Adam's rib. This is the Genesis story. And then eventually they're told they can have any fruit in the garden except for the one of knowledge. And if they eat it, they will die. Of course, they disobey and are expelled from the garden. And this is the very standard and this is the well-known version of the story from Genesis. And Zaman, I was going to ask him if he could start out by telling us some of the little variances and differences that are in the Islamic story of Eden, and maybe we could jump in from there.
The Islamic version is often assumed to be, just because we use the same names, or at least the name Adam is mm-hmm. shared between the Judeo-Christian and the Islamic tradition, then the assumption is made that the rest of the narrative would also be the same, but it's quite different, primarily because in the Quranic narrative there is no Eve. And therefore, we can assume that Adam represents both genders, both masculine and feminine. which is perhaps closer to how we identify ourselves as human beings now, containing both the feminine and the masculine. So in that sense, it's very different. There's also a critical difference in the sense that when they eat from the forbidden fruit, in the Islamic version, the responsibility is taken by both Adam and its spouse.
Hmm.
So I think we probably should have started with the narrative of creation, but anyway, there are two narratives. In the narrative of creation, Adam as an entity is acted upon, the other two actors being the divine God and Iblis, which would be the equivalent of Lucifer. And Iblis means the one who covers.
Hmm.
Or who's covered from.
Almost like a veil, a word.
The veiled one. And in the sense that when he was asked to bow before Adam, Iblis himself, being a jinn of a spirit made of fire, was unable to see the spirit of God in the physical form of Adam, and therefore abstain from prostrating, because he said, "I'm better.
Mm-hmm.
I'm made of spirit of fire," whereas Adam was made of earth. And the other angels did obey God's command, because they understood it that this prostration is not necessarily to the physical Adam, but to the spirit of God within.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this from which Adam, from which Iblis was veiled from this reality, not seeing that he was commanded to prostrate before the spirit of God within the body of Adam.
Hmm. And so would you say that it was in part because of his reduction of his image of Adam to his earth, to his matter, as opposed to ability to see beyond just the material qualities of Adam, that was maybe core to this problem? And the reason I ask is because it seems like an entry into materialism is a big theme in the Eden myth.
Well, we can. I mean, there are many ways to interpret this. One would be, especially in the Sufi tradition, it's believed that Iblis or Lucifer had taken an oath on the love of God that he had in his heart.
Mm.
And that oath was that he had vowed that he would prostrate before none other than God himself. And so he was trying to be loyal to the oath he had taken for the love of God. The other interpretation is that in expressing his arrogance, he sort of tapped onto or borrowed or stole or claimed the attribute that is exclusively God's, which is arrogance. Mm. Only God can have that.
Mm.
And no other being has the right to. And Iblis claimed arrogance. And so, therefore, he, in a sense, violated those. He tried to stay loyal to his vow of love, but in the process, he violated in claiming the attribute of God that he was not supposed to.
And so, some of this story actually shows up in some Christian versions, like Paradise Lost.
Mm-hmm.
Paradise Lost really focuses on Satan's fall and not just Adam's. And I haven't done the research yet to see if it was influenced by the Islamic story, but I think it's worth noting that the concentration on the fall of Satan it reappears.
John Milton certainly did that, partly because he had somehow was able to connect with the Eastern culture, with the Islamic culture. But since Muslims were vilified in Europe, he probably for that reason did not reveal his sources. Mm-hmm. But in certain cases, for instance, the use of the word India, going to India. In Islamic tradition, India symbolizes the Garden of Eden.
Oh.
Because it had the splendor and, you know, the gardens and all that.
Uh-huh.
So in the worldly form, India was the Garden of Eden, where you were going to, where the place you were idealizing. But I don't know whether he understood it in that sense or not, but he did use it. And perhaps a thing that we can extrapolate from that is that this desire of being in India or going to India in the spiritual sense eventually became a political thing. And in the age of exploration, it became a totally different ball game with colonialism and all that, because everybody, including Columbus, wanted to go to India. So we can connect the politics of it with the spiritual significance that was attached to it by the Muslim culture long before.
That's so interesting. And I know that the that Islam also had a huge role in some of the shadows of the Arthurian Grail legends. And one of the sequels kind of to the Arthurian Grail legends are the stories of Prester John coming out of India, and this forgotten, amazing Edenic church in India.
I think that the problem was that the Islamic culture and the Christian culture were polarized into an adversarial position so badly that many scholars were prevented from borrowing. And if they did, they did it in a way, you know, they had to hide the tracks that it, to make sure that it wasn't attributed to the sciences and the learnings of the other side.
Of the orthodox. So
right. And so I think that to go back to the argument, the Garden of Eden narrative, so we move on from the creation narrative, where, like I said, Adam was being acted upon by the two entities. Then Adam goes to the Garden of Eden, where Adam acts upon the other two entities, in a sense. So in the Garden of Eden, Iblis comes to the garden as Shaitan or Satan. So in the Quran, the word Iblis is never used in the Garden of Eden, and the word Shaitan is never used in the narrative of creation, because etymologically each term expresses something else. The word that is, the attribute that is used synonymously or right next to Shaitan is the whispering, and it comes through your heart. So therefore, Shaitan in essence is a negative propensity within you, not a separate entity outside of you, whereas in the garden of, in the narrative of creation, it was the other way around. And also it's in the Garden of Eden, Adam and its spouse, the two of them, it's a manifestation of creating a duo who are equally responsible for everything they do. So for one thing, we don't know if Adam was the male or the female or its spouse. We can't assign that role. So in the Quranic narrative, there is no primacy of gender established. The second most important thing is that when they, let's use the word commit, the act of eating from the forbidden fruit, they both take responsibility.
Not this, she did it first.
No such a thing.
Right,
there is
right.
no blame. There is no guilt. There is a responsibility. And the Arabic language has a beautiful way of expressing thoughts in the singular, in the plural, but also in the two person. Is that a double?
Oh, second person.
I think that there's a good grammatical term for it. I should know.
Oh, like
in the dual form.
Yeah.
So when you speak in the dual form, it's not singular one person, and it's not plural. It is specifically for two people.
Ah, I see.
So the response Adam and its spouse give to God for what they have done is that, oh God, we did it to ourselves. And they apologize like together for it.
Wow.
So they both take responsibility and accountability and are ready for the consequences. And since the consequences was expulsion from the Garden of Eden, then therefore there's no concept comparable to the original sin, mm-hmm. because even if they did it, they paid for it, and there is no blame. And in that sense, it is very, very unique. And so, again, there is no Eve. Now, with the absence of Eve, that pair are androgynous in a sense. Mm-hmm.
I would like to step back just a little bit and go backwards just a little bit to give both myself as well as our listeners who are not that familiar with the Islamic faith based upon the Quran. First of all, does the Quran have the same problem that the Bible does in the minds of many people in as much as it's been translated so many times from the original language that it's lost a lot of its meaning?
Quite the opposite.
Okay.
Quran is written and read today in exactly the same form as it was then.
And the language is?
And the language is Arabic, but more appropriately, I think we should say Quranic Arabic.
Okay.
And the Quranic Arabic is the standard Arabic, the classical Arabic, but classical not in the sense of an extinct language like Latin, but a classical language that is still a living language, and it's a standard by which a Moroccan and an Egyptian and a Saudi citizen, they have to kind of use that as a source mm-hmm. of authenticity for grammar and so on.
So if someone truly wants to understand mm-hmm. the faith, they need to read it from the original language. My question would then be, what about English-speaking Muslims?
Unfortunately, mine is not in Quran, in Arabic.
Well, the thing is that Muslims never read the translation unless the Arabic is right next to it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you would need to learn Arabic, the Quranic Arabic, in order
to... No, you don't need to.
No?
You don't need to. You can read it in English, but you have to have the Arabic right next to it. So this way, if a certain word is translated in a certain way mm-hmm. and you question its authenticity, you can always go to the Arabic right next to it.
Well, I wouldn't be questioning authenticity. I'd be questioning understanding. I don't want to understand.
There is a great website that does this, right?
Right.
It has the English version and the Arabic version. I wish I could remember what it was.
The one that I often recommend is called Islamicity.
Islamicity.
Islamicity.com. It's mm-hmm. spelled as one word. And there you go to the Quran, and after that, I think if you click on the comprehensive Quran or the comprehensive understanding of Quran, it gives you many versions of the translation. It gives you buttons for the recitation, for notes, and all that. So it's very extensive, yeah.
Help me to understand something else also. A Christian who believes in Jesus is called a Christian. Mm-hmm. And a Jew who follows the Torah and the Old Testament is called a Jew. But there are two names that I would know someone who is a believer in, a follower of Muhammad, and who reads the Quran, is either Islamic mm-hmm. or a Muslim. Mm-hmm. What's the difference and which one is appropriate?
Islam came in a sense as a religion to complete the mission of Jesus and of Moses. And so in that sense, first, theoretically, Islam is Judaism without its tribal connection. So it's a universal Judaism. Islam is also Christianity without deifying any individual human being as God or the Son of God.
He remains a prophet.
Right, yeah. But when we say prophet, we are not kind of demoting Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in the proper etiquette, the name of no prophet is mentioned unless you say peace be upon him or upon them, and no matter who the prophet is. So Jesus is, when Jesus is called as a prophet, it is promoted from the etymological sense, the way the Muslims use it. Linguistically, of course, for the West, I think the rank of prophet is, from my understanding, a little lower.
Mm-hmm.
When we are talking about Islam or Muslims, that term means those who have submitted to the will of God. And here, God need not be personified or anthropomorphized, but God is the power of the entire universes, in plural. That's how the Quran says it, which would be more like this cosmic or supercosmic or paracosmic power of harmony, in which everything whirls around some invisible and unidentifiable point. And that point, that centrality, is the centrality that brings everything into one. And so God has to be seen both, the Islamic terminologies are wahdaniyah and ahadiyah. One of them is speaking of the singularity, and the other one is speaking of the totality. And so when you submit to that singularity and totality, there's nothing left outside of that. So you simply submit. So labels like Muslims were sometimes called Mohammedans and all that, those are projections from the Western perspective. So Islam is submission to the will of that God universally.
So you're more, you like the word Islam much more because it says what it means about what the religion is, more than a Muslim comes from a different...
It's a derivative of the same term. Islam is submission and peace at the same time. So it has double, two, three tracks of interpretations. Muslim is the one who submits.
I see.
So if you say a certain individual is a Muslim, and his religion or her religion is Islam.
Okay.
Yeah, so in other words, the club is Islam.
Yeah.
And the member is
a
Muslim.
Yeah. It sounds to me as though you just described a trilogy. Judaism, Christianity, and Muslim. And it's a progression. Is that a fair assessment?
From
the Islamic perspective?
I would say from an Arab cultural perspective, yes.
Okay.
But from an Islamic perspective, the first prophet, prophet in the sense of inviting humanity to this whole world of harmony, a world of harmony, was Adam, and the last is Muhammad. So it is historically on this vertical axis and horizontally. It includes everyone. And so it's not necessarily the monotheistic traditions of the Middle East. Those are used and referred to in the Quran just because they were familiar to the primary audience at the time of the Prophet. However, it's often footnoted that the actual number of prophets are in the hundreds of thousands. And so, therefore, Buddha would be a prophet. You know, Lao Tzu would be a prophet. And there could have been prophets in many cultures. So it's not culturally restricted. But just like the concept of Adam and Eve that is often perceived in the Judeo-Christian context, I think this concept is also often perceived that, oh, because there are the Quran mentions the Jews, the Christians, and the Sabaeen, which is a fraction, another faction of Christians, I think, from the vicinity of Damascus. So therefore, these are the only ones who should be called, the terminology used is Ahlul Kitab, which is literally translated as the people of the book. But the correct translation would be those to whom the early generations to whom revelation has come, which is, again, very open and include anyone.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, I don't know if I want to use the word correct or appropriate, view of other religions and their beliefs by the Islamic faith is that they should be embraced.
Or at minimum valued.
And or at minimum valued.
Yeah.
And not wiped out.
Absolutely not. And that's why when you look at it in the historical context of 6th century, where in terms of the limitations of transportation and communication and all that, the prophet's greatest tradition, in my view, is that he was able to communicate with 16 world leaders. 13 world leaders at his time. That is phenomenal. Where, yeah, you know, in those times, your next door neighbor was an enemy you had to slaughter or fight or declare war against. But he communicated with 13 world leaders. And on top of that, throughout the Arabian Peninsula, he met regularly with Muslims, with Christians, with Jews, and with people of other faiths. In fact, his favorite activity was what we would call in modern terminology an interfaith council, where he met on this patio, and the word for patio in Arabic is sufa, and these were called ashabu sufa, the companions of the patio. And the companions of the patios were not Muslims. These were people of other faiths or of other religions that he would regularly invite and talk with them and discuss matters.
That is so cool. We're gonna make a subtext, subname for this room, Companions of the Patio.
I think it will be very appropriate.
So, on a sidebar, then, that's where we get our word for sofa? Possibly?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. A lot of the words that come from Arabic, either through Spanish or directly, or through Turkish. We use those terms, but now that you spoke of sofa, we also have to talk about the Ottoman, which was
well played.
What Christian Europeans, out of their hatred for the Ottomans, used for the piece of furniture on which they put their feet.
Feet, yes.
Which the Muslims consider a great insult.
Aha.
So
yeah.
Well, reasonable.
And so I want to – okay, so we're talking about a belief that has been around, am I correct, 1,500 years, roughly?
Yes. In the context in which Muhammad sort of took the torch. But we could, in the context of a more universal monotheism, we can go as far back as Zoroastrianism, because many of the concepts – perhaps originated in Central Asia, then they were brought through the Jewish tribes in Persia about 500 BC.
While also mixing into Greece. And
of course, and then once it gets mixed into this place that we call the Middle East, it's the middle of a lot of other things as well. And these concepts kind of went in many directions.
So we do have, just as we do in any belief system on the planet over the centuries, we have aberrations and splinters and factions and extremes on all sides within Islam, as we do in Christianity, as we do in Judaism, as we do in any of the faiths. I mean, it's for some reason it just happens.
People will
onto something and they'll run with it without reading the total context.
And the worst thing you can do is fight against that, because that means that you're censoring their effort to go do it however they want to do it.
Yeah, the idea is that from an Islamic perspective, remember that I give you the paracosmic world that is churning around a point. If we assume that to be a circle, that you see the circumference, you do not see the center. The center is not marked, but there's no way denying it.
Right.
Because without it, the circumference doesn't make any sense.
Exactly.
So we have to assume. So there is that God centrality. So a Muslim's mission in life is to live in a God-centered universe and make sure that that centrality is not taken by the ego within the human. It's when we humans act and give that centrality to our ego and we push God to the periphery when all those problems begin, because then I, the human with the big ego, become the center of whatever I consider to be authentic. And if anyone disagrees with me, they are all wrong. I become the only right one.
Right.
And so the whole emphasis in Islam, especially in this context, that one of its most useful terms, jihad, that has been so abused, is jihad is this struggle of moving from the human ego in the periphery to the God-centered universe in the mindset. that to that centrality. This is the true jihad, struggle mm-hmm. against the self.
Mm.
And people have
it's
taken
an internal
the,
process.
Exactly. So yeah. people have taken that term struggle
and put it
and
on
has
side.
Diverted it and externalized it and politicized mm-hmm. it, and it has become something that is used in almost 180 degrees opposite of what it's supposed to be.
In my conversations with rabbis talking about Judaism, talking about the Old Testament, and talking about the devil, Satan, et cetera, what I have come to understand, and you did, I really enjoyed your description of the Islamic
Shaitan,
mm-hmm. or what was it?
Iblis.
Mm-hmm. Whereas in Judaism, there is no, and again, I'm taking this information from what I had have gleaned from these rabbis that I've spoken with, it's not a physical entity. It's the lowest base nature of man.
Exactly.
It's not outside mm-hmm. ourselves. And it goes back to what you just said, that all of these processes are all internal.
The problem, I think, within the Muslim culture is that the term Iblis and Shaitan are used interchangeably without anybody bothering to see that, wait, this is a different thing. There is no more Iblis here.
Mm.
Iblis is the actor in the drama of creation,
right.
in the narrative of creation. That was a different story. That's gone.
Mm.
Once in the post Edenic
mm-hmm.
period. After the narrative of Eden, it has changed to Shaitan, and Shaitan is continuously used, like I said, with the term whisper. And the whisper is that of a negative propensity within you.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
and the Quran ends with a very short chapter giving exactly that warning.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at the text, At the extreme periphery, at the very, very end of it, the warning is given against that whispering of the negative propensity, which would show you things that will make you deviate from this harmony with nature. And so in that sense, we can see God or the divine as the nature, you know, the water, the ocean, the mountains, the whole environment. That is divine,
mm.
because the word Quran doesn't have verses. What is roughly translated as a verse for this cultural translation of the term is the word ayah, and ayah means the sign. This sign is to be understood as that which gives you an awareness of understanding the divine through it.
Mm.
But the same word is also used. The same word ayah that is used in the Quran is also used in the nature. So the Quran consistently
mm-hmm.
goes to the nature,
mm-hmm.
by the trees, by the mountains, by the sky and the water and the rain. And so it is trying to connect humanity with a much bigger environment than we are normally used to. So in this case, the nature is Quran too, because there are signs in it, just as the book, the text is a Quran. So there are Qurans everywhere.
Mm.
So to bring it back to the garden then, so then if
I don't think we had left it, but
thanks. Continuing with that, so you might maybe imagine if being in the garden is imagined as being one with the Creator, one with God, then it's almost like the way what you said, it's almost like being in the Quran to be in the garden. Or perhaps maybe we should realize that being in the garden is to be in the Quran. And I'd like to ask kind of two directions, but I'd like to, because I feel like there's a lot of real mystical wisdom, and we're starting to get into the psychology that's built into this story about the internal struggle with the self that wants to be more self-directed versus the one that wants to be more harmonious with nature. But I know you've spent a good bit of effort or effortless effort and exploring the mystical side of this text. And I was wondering if you might have any comments on how this unfolds to you in meditation.
I think in a lot of cases, Quran makes reference to events and entities, phenomena that are mentioned before. And so they do not necessarily have to be perceived in their historical context. They may not even have historicity as such. Mm. But the mystical aspect is, I think, the most important one. And in Islam, the two terms are esoteric and exoteric are mm-hmm. called the Zahiri and the Batini. So, and God is described in that sense, that God is both a Zahir, an outwardly manifested being, which is the nature, but it's also a Batin, which is that which is within, the invisible. And so in that sense, our very core being cannot be void of the God within us. And so, in that sense, not to interject any concept of the duality of the divine, and that is one, but that the belief that there's no dimension in terms of time and space that is devoid of the presence of the mm-hmm. divine, then we can safely assume that God is within us. Mm-hmm. And so, then being within that, I think, as far as the narrative of the Garden of Eden is concerned, I think they were told not to eat from that particular tree because you might become like angels or eternal. Mm-hmm. And I see the concept of eternal as an introduction of the element of time. Because eternity versus temporality. Mm-hmm. So, and suppose they had not eaten from it, then we would have been eternal. Mm-hmm. And if we were eternal, then time is irrelevant.
Maybe in a way it is to like an animal that may not be paying attention to their time. Maybe you're in time, but yes. That's not your mode of operation.
Right. And in terms of becoming an angel, the idea of the angel is that angels are created without having a free will. Mm-hmm. So here, in essence, there are three atoms that are created. The first is, Quran clearly says that we created Adam and then we gave him form. So mm-hmm. therefore, the spirit, the creation in the spirit comes first.
I like that a lot.
So the form was only a secondary. Hmm. So first, and then there's also emphasis that we have created you, humanity or our living being, from a single soul. So that single soul was that which came from God, a spirit, and it in a way became independent, or it was given its boundaries, if we can assume for just the sake of argument, that its boundaries were established as an independent entity. That would be the first Adam. The second Adam is the one that was created in form. Mm-hmm. We talked about the angels and Lucifer and lack of prostration.
I'll ask you to tangent into the, because I love the story of the tears and the clay.
The tears?
How he's created. I mean, his form. You're the one who told me that story.
Yeah. Well, I've told you a lot of stories, but let me finish the third. So the third Adam, which in my view is the most critical one, is the Adam that was created in the Garden of Eden. And this is the Adam that attains to the power of reason. Hmm. So when he is told that you can stay in this garden, you know, to use the modern terminology, it's just fully paid club mid vacation for you, don't have to do a thing. But then Adam and its spouse come and they, in a sense, break the law. And what they do is that it's often perceived that this created the third Adam, the rational Adam. So Adam is the rational, the consciousness that came into existence where it used the power of reason. Now, and the way many scholars analyze this and justify it, they say that Adam thought that if Adam and its spouse were worshiping God and not having any choice in this, not having any free will, then they were merely robots.
Right.
So they did not want to be robots. They attained to their free will and then worshiped God, saying, now I worship you because I have the choice not to, but I want to. Whereas before, I would have been worshiping only because there was no choice, and that's mm-hmm. the only thing I could do. Mm-hmm. So in this case, it becomes more independent. So I consider this the third Adam. So I think in this context we can see that in the third creation, Adam does not necessarily have to be perceived historical, 6,000 years or whenever. That is all not there. But Adam is the consciousness that human, as a member of the animal kingdom, attains to a higher level, which I think brings it right next to the concept of evolution. And one of the reasons the West has Western Christianity has problem with evolution is because it contradicts a lot of things in the Bible.
Right.
Whereas the Quran is telling you from the start that you're commanded to accept that which stands to reason.
Hmm.
So being rational is part of your faith.
Hmm.
And so when you're rational and you hear something like the theory of evolution, there is no way one would not accept it. And for that reason, when the theory of evolution was first proposed in the 10th century in the Muslim world, I think in 950, it did not make a wave.
Hmm.
People say, yeah, it's a great idea. It makes sense. And many scholars, poets, including Rumi and others, refer to it, and they have used it in their poetry that, yes, there is evolution.
I never had a problem with it. I just tell them when I was working for the Christian station, I said, I have no problem with evolution. I just believe God made it.
Right.
Did you guys see the new Noah movie? I mean, what a synthesis of creation and the Big Bang. I mean, he just did it.
Yeah, but the problem we have, not just here, now that the Muslim world is picking up on their Western-oriented education, which they got from Europe and America, they are using Christian arguments against the theory of evolution, thinking that if it was against religion there, then it should be against religion within the Muslim world too, without knowing that in their own tradition, it has been there for almost 1,000 years and it was no big deal. And so therefore, then, like again, the third Adam would be the rational, because that's what made us different from the jinns and from the angels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And I think you wanted to talk about the narrative.
I did. I want to hear about the creation part. It's beautiful.
That is more in the form of a legend, and I'm sure it has benefited from some cross-pollination in the various other traditions, including Christianity, Judaism, and perhaps Hinduism, Zoroastrianism too, which is when God commands the archangels one by one to go to bring the surface of the earth to create the form of Adam. Each one, the earth asks the questions like, what for? And the angel says, well, God has commanded it, so I have to take the surface of the earth so he can make a human being that will be walking on you and abusing you and treading and all the things that we experience now, how we disrespect our environment. And the earth says, in the name of the same God, leave me. Don't collect the surface of the earth. And the first three angels accept that. And the fourth one takes it in spite of all the pleading by earth, by Mother Earth. And God says, didn't the earth say anything? And I think it's the angel of death who says, yes, the earth pleaded, but I thought that your command was more important, so I had to ignore it because of your command. And so God says, well, then you will be also in charge of taking people's
because they're always going to be like, don't take it.
Right, when it comes to the time of dying. And so then it's all molded into a clay form, which was, they say, it rained on it for 40 days, and they had to need it. And
these were the tears of God, right?
And the tears of God. And all those things are kind of stories are woven into it.
Yeah.
But the idea is that the term used in the Quran for that clay is teen. And the same term is also used for the musicality of something. So when you see a potter makes a pot, they usually tap it to hear that clinking sound. If the clinking sound of a pot is sound, in other terms, then it's okay. And if it's broken, cracked, or anything,
it will
not make the same sound. So humans were, in that sense, made of that clinking clay from the tears of God and into an earthen form, which is now formed, but it has to now contain the Spirit of God within. So it becomes a jug of wine, and in this case, the wine being the Spirit of God, which should not be interpreted as the wine we normally talk about, which is prohibited in Islam. So your job is to fill yourself with the Spirit of God and become one with it. And if you're empty, you have to be empty yourself from worldly matters, cleansed, and then filled with the Spirit of God. And then you become that jug with the clinking noise, sound.
Let me ask you to elaborate a little bit on some of the symbolism. The tears of God is the rain.
Right.
Is there an explanation as to why God was crying those tears?
That's why I'm saying that perhaps a lot of this comes from a cross-pollination of other traditions.
So in Egypt, you have this story where the tears moisten the ground, and then humans are made from the sometimes just straight from the tears. And you have a Aesop's fable, I think, where Prometheus cries on the clay to soften it. There are a few
variations of that. Yes. And I'm sure that the Islamic culture. Now, I'm not talking Quranically here, except for the use of the word. That God says, I created you from the clinking clay. خلق الإنسان من الطين. And the teen is saying the tanana, and tanana is the sound you make when you like when you want to create a rhythmic pattern for music or for a song when you're composing. So the two go together there.
Okay. So again, the tears is just taken from different perspectives. And in terms of, it seems as though the aspect of clay is pretty universal through the various religions, because even in Christianity, in the Old Testament in particular, with Judaism, you know, we're made from the dust of the earth. And then, of course, there's ashes to ashes, dust to dust when one dies.
And we have become the earthlings. I don't know if that's derogatory, but
well, it depends on if you're an Orphic or a, what.
Yeah, but in Islamic poetry, in Sufi poetry in particular, the reference is always made. You know, I, the earthling or the being from the earth, as a great sign of piety that's mixed with the humility. And in that sense, in the origin, when Iblis says that he was made of fire, when you look at the flames of fire, they go up. Whether, of course, it's metaphorically speaking, it's just for oxygen they're thirsting for. But it's also rebellious, whereas the earth is submitting. It has surrendered. So Adam, being of the earth, is the one who has submitted, who has become a Muslim. So like I said before, all prophets are referred to in the Quran as Muslims. Abraham was Muslim, Jesus was Muslim. And that is not the establishing or imposing the identity of an organized religion on them. But being Muslim in the sense of conforming to the harmony, the paracosmic harmony. In that sense, so Adam was, who was our archetypal human in that sense, was the submitter from the start. So he had to be from the earth. He had to be earthling. The earth is down. So I think, in that sense, the contrast between a rebelling being and a submitting being is in the essence from which they are made, the four elements and all that.
Interesting. As I was sharing with Will in our first segment, I had the opportunity of interviewing a gentleman back in the 80s, and he was the president of an organization out of Las Vegas at that time. I don't even know if it's still around, and it was called CAMP, C-A-M-P. mm-hmm. Christians and Muslims for peace.
Yes.
And one of the things he said to me, and I would like you to maybe elaborate a little on this before we run out of time. He said to me, it's not something that I talk about a lot. It's not something I bring up, especially in large groups. But he said that what most people do not understand, mostly because they've never read the Quran, let alone the Old Testament, or the New completely, Christians and Muslims have more in common than do Christians and Jews. Do you think that's true?
We can go to history. When Muhammad was an orphan, a child, he went on a trip to Damascus, from Mecca to Damascus, with his uncle. And it was two Christian monks who saw in him the signs of being the next prophet, the one that they were waiting for. And it was these Christian monks who asked his uncle to watch over him and protect him and all that, because they had read in the Bible that there was another prophet who would be coming. I think the name of that prophet etymologically, it means exactly the same as Muhammad, the praiseworthy. But I think the translation into the Greek to Proclus, what's the term in the Bible? Proclitus, if I'm pronouncing this.
I'm not sure.
My Greek is not that good. Anyway, it has changed completely. But anyway, so that was the beginning. Then mm-hmm. when the revelation came to him in the cave in the mountain, he was so shaken and didn't know what had happened to him. So he ended his retreat prematurely, came home to his wife, and his wife was Christian, who belonged to a famous Christian family in Mecca. And after a few days when they just rested and relaxed and tried to make some sense out of it, and he couldn't, it's his wife, Khadija, who is recommending that he should go and visit her uncle, Waraqah bin Nufal, who is the greatest Christian scholar in Mecca. And it's this Christian scholar who accepts him as the next prophet and says, what you experienced was that you were visited by the angel Gabriel and a revelation was given to you, and however you want to describe it, that is your experience, but this is my understanding of that experience. So these four Christians were, from the start, ones who actually told him or confirmed his own inklings that he was a prophet. And so the Christians were also the closest, let me clarify that, Waraqah bin Nufal himself did not become a Muslim. He probably acted more scholarly than as a matter of conviction. So he did this kind of, if we can use a modern term, the analysis or psychoanalysis mm-hmm. of the experience he has had. Now, the Jews in Mecca, but primarily in Medina, they loved Muhammad's ideas of monotheism, that for the first time from the Arabs who had 360 gods collected in Kaaba, here comes a man who says there is only one God and nothing else. This idea of monotheism, they loved the idea, but they didn't feel comfortable that this idea was revealed to a prophet who is not of the Jewish tradition. The Arabs were so happy that, well, finally they have got a prophet too. But they didn't like his ideas because he was rejecting their many gods. So the only people from the Arabs and the Jews and the Christians that felt very, very comfortable with the prophet were the Christians. So there is that very, very close connection there. Not that they were just people of the previous revelation, but like I said, that Quran is not there to come and reject Christianity or reject Judaism, but is seen as the mission that started by humanity at the dawn of their consciousness from Adam,
mm-hmm.
is that has to be elevated from a tribal level, from a communal level, from if there is some such thing as a nationalistic level, to a universal level. And so when Muslims say, that there is one God, they are not saying it is our God.
Mm-hmm.
Claiming it in such a way is blasphemy in Islam, because you have no right to claim God. Yours, whether you're speaking ethnically, linguistically, or in terms of an organized religion. God is universal. And this is often not understood, and it's for that reason that the word we use for God, God has many attributes, but the primary word is Allah, which comes from the article al, the definite article, with law, nothingness. So God is the nothingness.
That sounds very Buddhist.
Which means unlike anything you can think of.
The empty point in the middle of the circle that you can't see or touch.
Exactly. Yeah. But you can't deny.
But you can't deny.
So in that case, you cannot claim him. You cannot give him a name. You cannot even say him. You can say her. Any attribute that you feel comfortable, any pronoun. That is the true God. Now, when we come to this problem of this cross-cultural dynamics that are often politicized, and European Christians, American Christians are saying, oh, they worship Allah. They don't know what they are talking about, but they are assuming that this must be the name of a particular God of the Arabs or in the peninsula or some such thing. And when Muslims hear Christians referring to God and the Son of God, they feel like this is a great blasphemy, because not only someone or something was added to the absoluteness of the one God, but that the line between the human and the divine is blurred. And as it has been in the course of history, when it is difficult to understand God, we either lower God to the level of our understanding, or we raise a human to the level of God, and this bridging is a problem. What Islam emphasizes is absolute monotheism, because the motto says, there is no God. Before you can accept one, you first have to clear your consciousness, your mindset, your thinking, completely of any God, any way you have perceived. So first you say, there is no God, but God. And so that when you say, but God, this is the nothingness. So in that sense, Muslims emphasize on this absoluteness so much that in its total absolute unity, unicity, and singularity, God cannot be contained in any cultural concept.
Wow. That is why I love these programs, because I learn, and they seem in one sense like very small things, but I guarantee you these kinds of things are going to stay with me for a long time to come. Mm-hmm. It ranks right up there with, again, what I shared earlier about what the rabbi taught me about Satan, the devil, the evil one in the Old Testament, is not an outside entity, but the low base nature. And now I understand better when I hear someone use Allah to refer to God, I'm going to know, even if they don't know what they're referring to, because a lot of people will just say Allah.
Right.
Just because they think that's the name of God in Arabic or in the Middle East or in the Muslim faith, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. When you're talking about the nothingness.
But then you think about
it. And you have to tell them the story about the circle.
Where we have come is that one of the reasons that Muslim and Islamic culture, they do not allow the manifestation, the presentation artistically or in any other way of God.
Mm-hmm.
There is no image. There is no picture.
Right,
regardless
right.
Of the looks and the appearance and all that.
Right.
So it cannot be tied to any culture. And that's why Islamic art primarily has concentrated on geometric shapes and, you know, the triangles, mm-hmm. and their geometry has, benefited from that a whole lot.
Sure.
So all the art of the tiles and the arches and all that, there is no image. So that humans are disallowed, in a sense, from even trying to imagine, which is not an easy thing to do, however.
Mm-hmm.
Our imagination goes wild with it. We always perceive God in some way.
Yeah.
But when the Quran is talking about God, it often, you know, in a few cases when it has tried to answer this particular human concern, after it gives, for instance, in one case it says, think of God as a light, the light within a niche, within a glass, and the glass within a niche, and the niche within a room, a building, a space, and it goes on and all that. And the light permeates through the whole thing.
Mm.
And it feeds on a flame that comes from the olive oil, which is not from the east, not from the west. In other words, even if you get that question, so where did the flame come from? Where did the oil, the source? It is trying to detach you from this whole thing. And then at the end it tells you, like a good professor will tell you, like, see how well I described it for you? So now you should understand. But Quran says no. These are only because humans may understand it that way. But God is nothing like that. So it says that, yeah, you have this thirst, you have this yearning, you want to know. We will give you an idea as to how and why you cannot understand it. Not that how and why you should understand it,
mm-hmm.
but how and why you cannot understand it, primarily because the human mind, the human intelligence and wisdom is not equipped for it, because the minute we perceive an understanding of God, we have reduced God to our perception. And the reason that the most common phrase, which again is very frequently abused, when Muslims say Allahu Akbar, God is great, that is to be understood that whatever you can imagine God is, it's bigger than that.
Hmm.
So first, you're not allowed to. But, well, even if you can't stop and you have assumed that, okay, it's just the size of this solar system.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back to the Middle Ages. If people thought that that was the whole world, okay, and it says it's bigger than that. And so then we move on and we find out that, oh, the universe is bigger than our solar system. There's whole, what is it called, clusters and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Galaxies. And I say, okay, no, it's bigger than that.
Well, but even if you take the literal translation, as you shared with us, of Allah,
mm-hmm.
the nothingness, mm-hmm. and you can't conceptualize the nothingness, but nonetheless, you think of that circle in that little point in the middle
right.
of the circle.
Yeah.
And that is Allah, it's greater than that.
Exactly.
Right.
But then again, the paradox is that on the one hand, it is the nothingness.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it's the
everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it's the totality yeah. of anything you can perceive. And so therefore, we humans often, it's probably just a natural thing, we perceive ourselves as the standard. Anything that's smaller than us is small, of course, and bigger than us. We are the standard. But the thing is that there is an infinity.
Mm.
Whatever you can think of as big, there is something bigger than that.
Yeah.
At least mathematically, you can argue it.
That's even what Aristotle said in the Parmenides. Yeah.
Exactly. And whatever you can think is small, that can be divided. Let's for the sake of argument, it could be divided by half. Mm-hmm. And once you perceive a half, that could still be divided by half. So there's no end to smallness,
yeah.
no end to greatness. So that's an infinity that goes in both directions.
And that's a very human way of thinking in large and small.
Yeah, and that will be that is the totality, which is an infinity at both ends, and that is God.
Yeah. What that raises in my mind is something that I thought of years ago in terms of getting closer to God. And this is the kind of the way I conceptualized it, that as a Christian, because that's how I was born and raised, you can never reach God. You can never actually connect, but you can get close by half and then by half again.
Mm-hmm.
But because it's always by half, you never actually get there. And that was what I was taught, not what I believe today, but what I was taught.
Interesting.
Was the path, that you just keep working it, getting closer and closer and closer, but you never actually attain. And that's in this lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of it's more than that here, obviously, in what you're describing in terms of, as you say, Allah Akbar, the nothingness is great.
Right.
You know, is greater than what I just said it was, the nothingness, or, you know, whatever you conceptualize the room as you shared. As we come to the end of our program, and what I like to do with my guests, I have three questions that I like to ask in the context. The first one is, and forgive me, I'm going to, your first name is pronounced Zamin?
Zaman.
Zaman.
Yeah.
Who is Zaman?
Time.
Quickest answer yet. Really?
No, no, no. I
Zaman
don't mean
means time.
What does it mean? I mean...
I understand.
Who is?
Yeah, it was...
You were being facetious, weren't you?
Trying to.
Genuine too, I think.
What kind of answer you want? My social security and the identity, or you want my how I perceive myself to be?
I don't usually prompt my guests as far as the answer. In the context of our conversation today, can you elucidate on who are you?
I'm a living being that has the divine within. So I don't have to reach to God because God is within me. But as a Muslim, when I have to do my prayers, five times prayer. The word prayer is not the correct word as far as the Arabic language is concerned. But so out of convenience, we use the one word prayer for about five, six different concepts in Arabic. But the daily prayers are called Salah, and Salah means to reconnect. So when we pray, we put our forehead on the ground. We connect with the earth. We get rid of the negative ions, or is that what it's called? So we, in that sense, we energize ourselves. We also put the highest point in our body, the forehead, out of humility on the ground, that that's where we had come from, that's where we are going. So we humble ourselves. So we recharge ourselves five times a day. Like, you know, people either take a coffee break or smoke something, or they put something from outside in here to recharge. But you can also recharge yourself spiritually to charge your battery. So the five daily prayers do that for you. And of course, there are also contemplations and all that. And then when all of that is done, out of the four, five, six different prayers, one of is called tasbih. And tasbih is the cleanliness. But the cleanliness is to, this connects back to the argument we had earlier, that there was no way I could not have perceived of God in some form or shape when I was doing my prayer. So at the end, I ask for forgiveness, that I want to cleanse my mindset from the perceptions that I had created of God, for which God is unlike anything that I had perceived. So the absoluteness of God is raised to a level, to a higher level, that even if out of this necessity of doing the prayer, my physical environment or something has kind of was not able to prevent and has created an image, clean that image. So in this case, God becomes the pure nothingness, and I become a mirror. And to go back to that first story of the narrative, is that when, of course, we cut that very short. So at one point, when Lucifer or Iblis is convinced that he had lost it altogether, he pleads with God and makes a request and says, give me some room so I could, quote-unquote, deviate these people from the right path. And he perhaps specifically points to the human heart, and God says, anywhere but the human heart. So the human heart is the mirror in which God reflects.
Reminds me of a poem by I think it's Sebastian Tiberius. I think that's his name. Anyway, it talks about the gods amongst themselves talking, saying we need to hide the truth from man because if he finds it, he'll be like us. You know, he'll be elevated. And they ponder, do we hide it in the stars? No, he'll find a way to get out there. Do we hide it in the ocean? No, he'll find a way to get there. Mountains, I mean, everywhere. And then one of them realizes, we'll hide it in his heart. He'll never look there.
That's the trouble with most of humanity today.
Right.
Yeah.
That we don't
Very
go
good.
To our heart. Yeah. And we create, we try to create a closeness of the physical form and the perceptual form with the God, which is not possible.
Yeah.
And in contrast to that, we create distance with humans with whom we are close already.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we want to get distance from that with which we are close,
mm-hmm.
and we want to be close to that from which we are distance. And this is another struggle, is that we have not measured the value of it, that God is that energy, that, let's say, to speak metaphorically, that that power that lights us up as a light bulb. And without that, we are nothing. There is no light.
Mm. My next question has to do with the work that you do and what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing?
That's assuming I answered the first one satisfactorily.
You did. It actually elaborated wonderfully.
I teach where people don't show much interest in learning. I write... I write prose, poetry, a few languages, and my most favorite hobby is thinking into the impossible. And I read the Quran, but I rarely read it for recitation. I read it for contemplation at times, and I read it for thinking and for analyzing, and I find new angles in understanding it in a way that perhaps, at least from my limited knowledge, that it was not understood before. Mm-hmm. And the concept of the androgynous atom we discussed is perhaps one of those
mm-hmm.
that I'm certain that there are a lot of Islamic scholars out there who would disagree with me. And I like that because it's in the disagreement where we can perfect our own learning, however imperfect that might be. So that is, in a sense, a disclaimer also to what to everything we talked today.
And finally, who inspires you?
I think it is spontaneous. I have had my best inspirations on mountaintops. When I was a child, I just loved to climb the highest peak. And it often came at the end of a lot of disappointments because every peak that I saw immediately in front of me, in my mind, that was the highest.
Mm-hmm.
And then there will be another. And then, you know, this thing mm-hmm. would get repeated. And so when I'm on a very, very high mountain for some reason, I feel very, very calm. Other than that, there are individuals and ideas that are not shared with my living in this historical juncture that I connect with through my dreams and through my wonderful imagination, for which I'm very, very grateful. So I have a lot of companions, and a lot of them have lived centuries back, and perhaps some of that is reflected in my poetry. When people read it, they often attribute it to someone a long time ago because it's so totally out of not this world space-wise, but it's out of this world time-wise.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't do that deliberately. It's just I happen to think like that. And my early... I think one of the critical inspirations came by sheer accident when I was about to submit my PhD dissertation. I was looking for just one last source to check in a library. And I was going through the stacks of books, and I saw the word Arabic, and I said, Arabic in the law library? So out of place? Why would it be here? So I walked past it, and then I was curious. I said, well, let me check. So I come back, and there's this thick book, and it says Ibn al-Arabi. Mm-hmm. And I open it, and it talks about this great thinker in the Muslim world, and especially in the mystical philosophy. And I just read that introduction on it, like one, two, three paragraphs, and I said, I'm about to get my PhD, and I had never heard of this person. Who is this person? And that's what started me off, and I copied one chapter on his life, which was about like 20 pages. And so after I had submitted my work, and I was just happy, like, you know, a sense of relief and, you know, achievement. So I said, let me look at that article. And I went and sat in my garden, which is backyard, but I glorified by calling it garden. So I sat in my garden. I think it was probably like 7, 8 o'clock in the morning. And I don't know if I even had breakfast, because I thought I'll be coming back to the kitchen to eat. But I was there until past 2 o'clock. And I had to read every paragraph over and over and find such depth that I could hardly understand it linguistically, let alone understanding it philosophically. And I cried and I laughed and I was lost. I just didn't know what had happened. So I was so completely transformed that if I hadn't written my dissertation, I probably would have given it up on that day. Because I thought I had wasted my whole life.
Wow.
And, you know, I was a Fulbright scholar. I was going to this university, that university, got several masters and all that. And I said, well, that was the world. And then I realized that they would be nothing more than just a piece of paper. And then I wanted to discover myself through this, because I thought the world out there existed, but I didn't even know who I was.
Like to wrap the program up, you mentioned your poetry, and can you leave us with one of your works?
I could read one. I'm not good at reciting.
Okay.
Or exciting, but we'll give it a try.
Please do.
This one, I think, probably is more up to what we have been discussing, and it's called "In the Prison of Perception." So I think you would know. You probably already can guess what I mean by that.
Mm-hmm.
In the prison of perception, in the midst of darkened seas, our shadows still project a scribbly silhouette, an othered face of God. From refracted revelations, we carve niches and wide spaces. We make places, we make people, with identities galore. In heaped high stratifications, we can see complementarities of colors, hues, and shades. Fine distinctions of that paintbrush-hilled divine. We indulge in retrospection as we distance to disown askance appearance, contemplating mirrored images, but the mirror doesn't flinch, nor does it blink, defies effacing the true image we disdain. We can't change. We break the mirror. Shattered crystals hold persistent self-reflections. Shadows trace our projection, recreating the created. We create even great gods in our image, then claim opposite as truth. Narcissistically, we worship these projections. We prostrate in adoration, return gestures in elation, spiraling circles of illusion, a circumference in search of a lost center. For too long, shadows have claimed us in their own distorted darkness, tracing self in its own paces from now here to nowhere. To nowhere. Ah, the virtues. To be different of indifference, to be one with every being. Leave the solace of seclusion. Fly away to the far distance blue horizons beneath freshly painted clouds on the edge of great divide to awareness in wholeness where matter doesn't matter and mind surely doesn't mind. In divine domain of splendor and celestial beauty's glances remain still to be reflected in all beings once again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I almost want to say amen.
Yeah, we could go to the pharaohs.
We certainly could. Again, thank you so much
for
joining
thank
us,
you.
For sharing what you have with us today. I got to tell you, this is a great education.
Well, it's education for me too. A stirred mind is what we have to repeatedly appreciate. And thank you for giving me that opportunity.
You're very welcome. Yeah. Will, thank you so much for joining us here on the program again. And we will talk to you next month at the end of May. And I have a feeling we'll be going to the stars.
That's right.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. This has also been Mythosophia, and we have been entertaining the depths of myth and wisdom. Until next time, love to Lal.